From Bressel by the Aster Sea, Dante said. The two men raised their eyebrows. Dante licked his lips. But we left it months ago, and now we have a couple miles still to travel, it seems. Good day.
I told you, Blaze said once they'd headed up the street. We had no way to know that, Dante said. It's the tallest thing in town.
And if we'd guessed wrong, we might have spent so long wandering we'd missed the sermon. That's right, we'd be wandering for 2 days. Dante glanced toward the cathedral and citadel, whenever their great heights could be seen above the clutter of the streets. He had the unpleasant suspicion the clergy of Aron didn't limit their control of the city to its finest church. Things got louder, busier, and fouler the further they travelled toward the city centre. They walked through a decent number of poorly dressed people speaking two or three different tongues and gazing up at the ruin and age like all newcomers to a major city, but despite the pilgrims' presence and the locals hurrying on about their business, it felt less alive than a place as middling as Wetton or the Gascon town they'd stopped in along the way. They made good time through the modest traffic, reaching what the man had called the inn gate within a half hour. Four men bearing pikes twice their height and dark-plumed helmets flanked the gate to the next ring of the city. The last set of walls, besides the citadel itself. The guards' eyes tracked the comers and goers with the alert boredom of those used to standing on the same square yard of street all day. Dante and Blaze settled against a nearby building to share a drink of water and watch the people pass. For no reason they could see, half the company peeled from their post and stopped a dirt-smeared man on his way through the gate. They spoke in the garrulous local language, voices pitching up, and then the guards flung down their pikes and dropped the man in a flurry of punches. They picked up his unconscious body by the armpits and dragged him through an iron-banded door set into the stonework beside the gates. Abrupt shifts in the grey of the stone betrayed where attackers had successfully bombarded them down, but in contrast to the earlier walls, these ones were unbroken, unadorned by the heads and quarters of criminals and the unwelcome, clean from moss and lichen. These walls looked like the rock on which the enemy waters would break. When Dante crossed beneath them, sharp eyes meeting those of the pikemen, the city within the tight circle of the inn gate looked whole, as prosperous and peopled and mighty as the noble quarters of Bressel. At its centre, no more than a quarter mile distant, the sheer, smooth walls of the citadel dwarfed all but the spire of the cathedral. It had once been a palace, Dante knew, the ancient capital, but now it looked more like a castle. Narrow slits were placed along its curtain walls, and the towers they connected. Among the crenels he saw the far-off shapes of men, standing watch on what lay below. "Now that is a big building," Blaze said, letting himself look impressed. "What do you want to bet it's where Samarand calls home?"
"I don't know. My life."
Dante snorted. They strode down the street. Men with half a foot in height on them shuffled out of their way without seeming to know why they were moving. They turned another corner, and before Dante looked up, he thought he could sense the vast weight of stone pressing on him with greater force than the rocky walls of the mountains had. He lifted his eyes. They'd found it. To his right, the keep. To his left, the church. The Cathedral of Ivars was built with clean lines and elegant swoops that made the intricate buttresses and delicate arches of the great churches of Bressel look like an unshaven man in a dress. For a full minute, they gazed at the charcoal-hued stone spearing up into the sky. Two thick towers flanked a central one, whose flattish face seemed sewn together by a series of vertical lines standing out from the stonework. From the gigantic block of the body of the church, the main spire was stacked in three discrete levels, two of them squarish,
the second somewhat narrower than the one beneath it, and crowning them, reaching so high as to stab the stars, a conical tower of dizzying steepness. At its apex, Dante saw a plain ring of steel, the icon he'd come to know as Orion's.
"I think I need to sit down," Blaze said, falling back a step, arm held out behind him for balance.
"My gods," Dante said. He fought the desire to fall to his knees.
"That must be... that is really, really tall."
500 feet, Dante guessed. "I've got no goddamn clue."
"Higher than the Odellion of Bressel. That's 366.
"By a lot," Blaze said. He lowered his gaze and shook his head. Nobody was paying them much mind, Dante saw. A few others were standing on the far side of the street, trying to catch the cathedral's full perspective. Others filed in and out from its great doors, eyes downcast, speaking softly, if at all.
"Let's go inside."
"What?" Blaze said. "Just walk right in?"
"I think it's okay," Dante said, jerking his chin at the others. "They don't look any cleaner than we do."
"But what if Aron knows?"
Dante frowned at him, then led them up its steps and to the double doors. 10 feet high and 5 inches thick, but they swung easily, noiselessly. Dante followed a couple other pilgrims through the foyer, and then they were in its main chamber. Captured space soared above them. The ceiling arched like the keel of an upside-down boat, or like the ribcage of Fanon's Leviathan. It was the single largest room Dante had ever seen. At its far end was a richly draped dais, a red pedestal and a number of metal trappings gleaming brightly in the light through the shadow-cut glass windows and hundreds of candles lining each wall. The front half of the room was consumed by row on row of benches, their wood stained as dark as silt. Between where they stood and where the benches began lay a clean floor of creamy stone, tiled with the 12-part circle of the Celicet. Recessed alcoves along the walls sheltered icons and minor shrines to the prophets of Orion. All that space looked empty as the air beyond a cliff, but there must have been 8 guards and 40 pilgrims in the main chamber, lighting prayer candles in the alcoves, kneeling before the altar, standing near the room's edges with their hands over their mouths, and eyes drifting across the wings of the ceiling.
"Awfully wide open," Blaze said.
With small gestures, Dante mimed sighting down an arrow shaft and letting fly toward the altar. He raised his eyebrows at Blaze, who shook his head.
"I don't know."
"Imagine it packed," Dante said. "With soldiers, maybe." Dante headed over to one of the walls. Footsteps and coughing echoed from front to back, but as long as they kept their voices to a murmur, he didn't think their words would carry. He contemplated an alcove presenting a 3-foot statue of a holy man he didn't recognize, a work of thickly impressionistic muscles and blunt features, its clean lines mirrored the greater build of the cathedral.
"Could take cover in one of these," he said,
"nearer the front."
"I'm guessing those benches aren't intended for the huddled masses. Might not be able to get too close."
Dante nodded, trying to gauge the distance from alcove to altar. It was a ways. Somehow, it was harder to guess indoors, inside a building where a full-grown man had no more presence than a mouse.
"How's your archery?" Dante said.
"Shitty."
"That much better than mine."
Dante sighted in on a couple of decently dressed men standing in front of the main altar. He couldn't tell one from the other. He and Blaze would have to be closer to stand any good chance of landing an arrow, if they could even get the bow through the door. If they had a straight line of sight, which was doubtful when the crowds filled the place up, and the closer they got for the purpose of improving their chances of a true strike, the further they'd be from the doors that would let them outside.
"No," Won't work.
Spell?
Blaze said, catching his eye. Not sure my range is any better. Dante rubbed his eyes, trying to remember the furthest he'd fired the nether. The tree in the graveyard in Wetton, probably. And that'd been barely half the distance they may need.
They had 2 days yet till the Sermon of Samarand.
They could return to the wilds to let him test and flex the reach of his mind, but such an attack would rest on a full foundation of assumptions. Was this sanctuary warded against hostile employment of the Nether? For that matter, was there any such thing as wards? Samaran's priests, would they be as wary for otherworldly assaults as the pikemen would be for those of steel?
I'm thinking this isn't the place.
I'm rather doubting that castle outside would be any easier. Dante bit his lips between his teeth. She'll have to walk here and back from it.
Blaze huffed, the puff of air ringing from the walls.
He lifted his eyes and lowered his voice.
From just across the street?
Dante nodded.
There'll be crowds, confusion, and probably no more than a minute when she's in the open. Not much time for the right moment.
You know, this was never that hard all the other times.
Not counting all the times we were nearly killed, Blaze said, eyes full of scorn.
Can we go back outside? Talking about this in here is creeping me out.
Yeah. Gods, it's beautiful.
They left its hushed shelter for the bright daylight and the relative roar of the babble of pedestrians. Across the way, the citadel stood as solid as if it had been carved straight from a hillock.
We'll get here early, Dante said.
His voice wasn't yet back to a normal level.
Watch how she comes in. They'll probably follow the same route back.
Blaze bit his pinky nail, spattered into the street.
How is it? He said, staring at the battlements, the flags snapping in a wind they barely felt at ground level.
They seem to know our every move when we're 1,200 miles away, but here we are close enough to piss through their bedroom window and we're free as an eagle.
Probably they don't recognize you with your hair down and your eyes, Dante said, not to mention that stupid beard.
Yours is so much better. Looks like you sewed a rat's tail to your lip.
Rat's tails are hairless.
Well, imagine they're not.
2 days, Dante said.
Blaze bit another nail.
Only if it looks good.
Maybe the whole city's lit up with the stuff of the book, Dante said. It'd be like trying to find a lantern held in front of the sun.
Blaze wrinkled his brow.
Are you basing that on anything at all?
Well, it would make sense.
You're an idiot.
Nobody's come through that gate the whole time we've been here, Dante said, nodding at the closed doors and the front side of the citadel's walls. Do you think that's odd?
Oh, yeah. When I was growing up in our castle back home, we let people in and out all the time. The walls were just to impress the neighbors.
I mean, you don't need to keep them closed all the time when you've got all those soldiers.
You'd think we'd at least have seen someone carrying food in or garbage out, or couriers waving letters around so we can see how important they are. There hasn't been a thing.
Closed in the middle of the day.
Yeah,
Blaze said, folding his arms.
It is a little odd.
I'm going to ask someone, Dante said, straining his ears for the sound of their native language.
What?
What did Robert tell you about questions?
Suddenly you're on his side. Just because he's a prick doesn't make him wrong.
Excuse me, Dante said, flagging down someone who wasn't dressed in fur. Excuse me.
He put a hand on the man's shoulder. The man spun, face dark, but his eyes went guarded when he met Dante's.
Can you tell me why the citadel's gates are closed midday?
No one goes in,
the man said in a thick accent.
Ever?
Ever.
No one?
The man rolled his eyes. Priests go in, no one else. That's why they call it the Sealed Citadel.
Ah, Dante said. I thought that was just an expression.
No, this is an expression, the man said, following up with something obscene.
He walked away. Did you hear that? Dante said to Blaze. Yes, but I think you'd break your back before you reached it.
About the citadel.
Yeah. Blaze tipped his head at the high walls. So what?
So? We can't get in.
We might just have this one shot at Summerand.
Yeah, and maybe she'll recant her wicked ways and off herself before we have to do it for her.
Blaze's mouth twitched. His brows drew together, creasing the skin between and above them.
At that moment, he no longer looked in any way young.
There's no way we can know until the moment comes. Let's not talk about it till then.
Chapter 13. Instead of talking, they prepared. The next day, Dante sold the horses, reasoning it was better to take whatever they could get now than to get nothing when they were stolen. In his haste, he received perhaps a third their worth, and in coin noticeably blacker and irregular than the Malish chucks that had been minted within his lifetime, but to him it seemed a fortune, a rogue's retirement and the coin of the realm. They blew half of it on clothes, on fur-lined black cloaks and gloves, on unpatched trousers and the padded doublets of the high-collared fashion popular in the rank of Narashtovic. Dante chose red, Blaze a deep pine green. No one would mistake them for princes, but neither would they any longer be indistinguishable from the gutter sewage. They found a barber, were shorn of their wispy beards, and had their shaggy hair shortened and straightened. In the clean sunlight of the street, Blaze brushed stray hair from the back of his neck, a strange smile on his face.
I feel like a jacketed ape, he said.
We look like traders, Dante said, feeling the weight of the coins in his pocket. Maybe even minor nobles. They won't turn us away.
They walked around the city till long after dark, not yet ready to forfeit the long hours to sleep. At last, legs weary from the trip to market and back to the cathedral and two circles around the sealed citadel and a trip to a public house, they returned to the home they'd made inside the first wall and stretched out on a pile of their old clothes and blankets.
I wonder how Gabe fared,
Blaze said into the quiet and the darkness.
I bet he turned that monastery into a fortress.
And the knighted monks?
Why not?
Picture it, Blaze said.
He laughed through his nose.
Those bony old men sallying forth on goatback, waving butcher knives and rakes.
The rebels don't stand a chance, Dante chuckled.
They were silent for a while.
He'll be fine, he said, mind on all the weeks that had gone by since they'd last seen him.
And the Southlands had been under threat of fire when they'd left that world behind.
We'll see to that.
In the ethereal dawn hours before Samaran's sermon, they walked to the bay at the north edge of the city and gazed out at the subdued waters of the northern sea. Grey, brackish on the breeze, calmed by the sandbars at the bay's mouth and the arms of land to either side.
How many men can say they've seen both this and the Aster?
Blaze said, kicking rocks through the fine dirt on the beach.
I'm glad we came, Dante said,
uncertain what he meant.
The sun struggled against the mists of the waters, cloaked and concealed. He wished he could have watched it rise one last time.
They arrived some 3 hours before the sermon. Already the streets were thick with people. Men in rags with strips of burlap tied around their feet, men in finery to shame Dante and Blaze's new clothes, passels of boisterous merchants whose rings shone in the sunlight. Norrin loomed above the crowd like the Cathedral of Ivars above the dead city. Dante shifted the sword at his belt. Robert's warning about the curiosity of foreigners had cowed him into asking no questions about the legality of bearing arms in this place, but they'd seen many men in the streets who wore blades without worry, including men of obvious lowness and poverty. And this day was no different. He supposed a couple thousand years of constant invasion had made lax the laws of arms so strict in Bressel. Dante's nerves felt as tight as the morning before the execution that wasn't. He sipped often from his water skin, and halfway wished he had something stronger. The boys spoke little, eyes on the crowds, eyes on the men standing post on the walls above the keep's great gate. An hour before noon they entered the cathedral. Half full already, and still the streets were packed. They returned outdoors, restless and beware, ambling down the broad way. They leaned against the side of the thick wall of the house, of some noble estate. The shield above its gate wore the black and white of Baden, and the same spiral horns Dante still wore around his neck. He'd seen other men wearing them, too, men dressed in the plain and frill-less clothes of traders, who profit too little to ever stop for festivals and feasts, but he had no idea what the horns meant to those who saw them, whether they were doing him any good to wear them. Noon came. The bells of the cathedral pealed for 3 full minutes. The crowd quieted, then heaved with the volatile energy of anticipation, eyes on the silent gates. The last bell rang and wavered in the cold, crisp air. One moment slipped by, then another. The groan of ropes and clank of chains cut through the babble. They hushed as if commanded by the earth itself. Guards emerged from a small door by the gate and helped guide the huge gates apart. Behind them, a grill of iron bands, as thick as Dante's arm, lifted a final foot and locked into place. A stream of footmen, bearing swords and short pikes, and dressed in the black and silver of the Watch of Narashtovic, marched from the walls of the citadel to the street, carving an open lane to the doors of the church. They assembled 2 solid lines, arms presented, chins lifted, heads held immobile, as a small retinue of fancy-dressed men and clergy in soft, thick-folded robes entered into the open space. A chant thrummed through the silence. A foreign song shot through with grace and loss and renewal. Dante stood on his toes, and at the center of the procession he saw a woman in a silver-trimmed black robe that clung to the swing of her arms and the sweep of her legs. Her open face was aged, but not worn. Rather than the crumbling edifice of something that had once been grand, her features looked like the accumulation of a strength that could only be built through long years, the way a cathedral, as eternal as Ivar's, could only be built by 2 or 3 or 5 generations of architects, devoting their lives to its completion. A single black braid ran down her back. Dante heard Blaise draw his breath. Her name rippled through the crowd.
"Straight from the keep," Blaise said, low.
Dante nodded.
"Right out in the open."
The men from the keep moved with formal deliberance. None looked younger than 40, most much older, bearing varying degrees of beardedness and baldness, walking on knees and hips stiffened by the clutch of time. A single Norren walked with them with ponderous strides. 90 seconds spent crossing the street, no more, and then they walked through the same cathedral doors as everyone else would. When the last priest had disappeared from the street, the castle guard turned as one and filed back through the citadel gates, leaving behind a small detachment of troops, half of which followed the retinue of clergymen within, while the other half split itself to posts on either side of the church doors. The crowd woke from the spell of having looked on something holy and piled up through the doors. Elbows jostled Dante's ribs and back. Blaise clung to the back of his cloak to keep from being separated. They squeezed inside, and after that crush of people,
The soaring interior of the cathedral felt as open as the head of a hill. Seated to either side of the dais at the great hall's rear were the monks and priests of Samaran's detachment. She was nowhere to be seen, though through the close-pressed masses and the shaggy heads of Norrin and the faint smoke of candles and braziers, she could have been standing at Dante's shoulder without him having the wits to notice. By habit and instinct as deeply felt as the drive that calls sea salmon to take the rivers and streams of their birth, the men with fine dress and tongue-tripping titles had settled in the benches at the front, and like striations of rock the boys had seen in the shelves of the Dundon Mountains, the men and women who filled the temple grew progressively grubbier the closer they got to the front doors. Blaise said something Dante couldn't catch. He tugged Dante's cloak, and they slipped off to the right, cutting through the relatively loose crowds that filled the space between the solid clumps of men lining the alcoves and the clustered masses toward the church's center. After a minute of rubbed shoulders and dirty looks, the fresh clothes matched those of the men around them. They stopped roughly two-thirds of the way toward the altar, perhaps 80 feet from where Samarand would speak. It would have been impossible to fire a bow within these person-choked confines. Blaise leaned toward Dante's ear.
"So this is the part where they make us wait to remind us just who Aran loves most, right?"
"Lots of guards out front," Dante said.
"Lot of crowd, too. That could help."
"Yeah."
Dante rested his hand on the pommel of his sword, and wondered how many priests up on that altar could channel the Nether.
He could sense it, he thought.
Power like a gaping chasm. When he narrowed his eyes, he thought he could see the shadows hovering around them. Perhaps it was just his eyelashes. He giggled, covered his mouth. Seconds birthed and died as the masses waited, and he found himself strangely awed by the precision of time, ever-evolving, matched with the undeviating courses of the sun and the moon, and the five roving planets, and the backdrop of the stars. Perhaps these believers were right. Something so regular could only exist through the glory of the gods of the Seleset. The crowd inhaled as one. There she was, alone at the center of the dais, materializing as if she'd always been there. Her hands were folded in front of her stomach. Despite her robes, Dante could tell she was a thinnish woman, possessing no more body than was necessary for the discharge of her responsibilities. He had a clearer look at her face, both plain as a farmer's wife and unadornedly magnificent as the standing stones of the long-dead people they'd seen in the hills on the northern side of the mountains. It held no arrogance, however, none of the severe lines of austerity that should come with the isolation of her holiest stature.
"Welcome, travelers," she said into the light buzz of voices.
Her voice spread through the acoustics without echo. The people fell utterly silent.
"Welcome to this place and to this time. Many of you have come from distant lands, cities and hamlets I couldn't pronounce." She gave a wide smile, then let her face grow sober. "Let us first offer prayer to any who may have left this world along their way. It's a cold season, a dark time, though we see the promise of dawn, and will soon feel the warmth of the sun. Not everyone who stepped out on the path toward that sliver of sunrise now plants their feet inside this cathedral. They are honored, but not grieved on, for they are with Aran now, called back to the form from which we all sprung. Let us remember the years they spent among us, in this world."
The people bowed their heads as one. A couple of coughs broke the stillness, but no one spoke. Blaise leaned in toward Dante again, whispered so softly he could barely hear it.
"She's speaking Malish?"
Dante opened his mouth to offer some insult, then stopped. He hadn't thought about what language Samarand would choose in this swapped-up place, or how they'd hope to understand her, assuming she chose Gascon. But she spoke clearly, and without accent. There had been a kind of hum to her words, though, an undertone which couldn't be explained by any special architecture of the church. It was as if she spoke through a vibrant fog that cleansed her words, even as it enshrouded them. A trick of the nether, perhaps. Dante shook his head, shrugged. "Thank you," she said softly. "May they find peace in the kingdom beyond our own." She gazed out over the crowd, letting long seconds speak of her contemplation. "These times are indeed troubled. It's easy to forget we're not alone in our strife and struggle, that our fathers and mothers, and their mothers and fathers, saw troubles every touch as serious as our own. It's been that way as long as our city, and indeed the race of man, can remember. There is a story I've heard that speaks to this, from a place very far from here, and from a time that's beyond the memory of any of our long lines, about a young man named Ben." She paced forward on the dais, gave her head a little tilt, spent a moment examining the mathematical beauty of the arch of the ceiling. "Ben was the second of the 11 sons of an old and clearly well-loved man, a miller who'd lived on the banks of the same river all his years. For all his heart, his home was humble, and as his sons came of age, he could no longer support them all in its modest walls. When the last of them reached the age of 15, he gathered them in the yard, for none of his simple rooms could contain them all, and said to them as follows: 'I've been your father for many years, and I've done what I can to see you never want for food or shelter. But now I'm old, and you are young, and it's time for you to become men of your own right. Go out into the world. Make your fortune. Return here in 7 years' time so we may share your joys, for I know all of you will grow to be fine and honest men.' His sons nodded, and they embraced and went their separate ways. The years passed, and it was as their father had said. They prospered, found the love of wives and the respect of men. At 7 years, they ventured back to their home, families in tow, to rejoin their father and support him as he had once supported them. The father and his sons wept openly when they all were back in one roof. They built a grand house around the old, one to keep them all in warmth and safety, and after the final hammer stroke, they gathered in its airy kitchen to toast each other and tell the stories of their 7 years apart. 'All of you are healthy, wise, rich,' he said, though Ben, in his unclean robes, showed no wealth of coin and possessed no more than the clothes on his back and a sad-eyed black hound. 'Tell me, what have you become, my sons, and how you've made your way in this world?' 'I have become an armsman, strong of arm and stout of heart,' said the eldest. 'I am a farmer, a man of wide fields and sweet grain,' said the third son. 'I am a harlequin of the king's own court,' said the fourth, 'and every time he calls me, my tricks lift the clouds from his brow and lift his heart to rule with the wisdom of the gods.' And so they went through the line, each telling the story of his wealth and place, until, at last, only Ben remained, second son Ben, swathed in his simple robes and unshod feet. 'And what wealth may you share, Ben?' the father said. 'I am a monk,' he said.
I have no temple, no mass or brotherhood to call my own, and I live only through the charity of alms. But I am at peace, and perhaps I can bring that to my brothers and my father." The father smiled, and again embraced his sons. But the others looked askance at Ben, lone among them, who'd have no place in the gardens of the nobles.
Samarand paused her story and drank from a plain copper cup. She smiled out on the people. For the first time, Dante thought he saw a crease of skin beneath her eyes.
"And so the brothers lived together as they'd done while young. The almsmen kept their fields free of bandits. The farmer fed them each meal. The harlequin made them laugh and clap each eve. All shared their gift and talent. Even Ben, silent Ben, would tell them stories of the gods and their prophets when asked. And for a time, they did live in peace. But as with all men who don't understand those whose joy comes from a different source, in time the brothers grew resentful and jealous. 'Ben swings no sword,' the almsman said. 'Why should I protect him from the thieves?' 'Ben grinds no bread,' the farmer said. 'Why should I feed him of my harvest?' 'Ben knows no dances,' the harlequin said. 'Why should I pass his long hours with mine?' And so they decided to cast Ben from their house. The father tried to argue, saying Ben was of their blood. He was wise as any, but he was old and couldn't stand against these 10 sons. And so they took Ben up, breaking his fingers when he tried to hold fast to the doorway of the house, and they cast him on the street with his dog, penniless as the day he'd returned. Ben grieved for the loss of his brothers and his father, but he told what he'd learned to the beggars and the vagabonds, and they shared their bread. He preached in the street, and the people came to hear his words, until no traffic could pass that throng in the square, and still the crowds grew larger. A year from when he'd been cast out, the people of the town came together and built him a temple, a proud, simple shrine of stone to hold his flock and hear the things he'd learned in his years and travels. Twice each week, Ben spoke his sermons, and in those times he smiled to see the joy he brought to those who'd listen. The brothers heard of this temple, came to town to see it. It was simple enough, but beautiful in its way, and when they looked on it, the shame of what they'd done to Ben burned inside their hearts. Instead of coming to him with open arms, they clustered together in angry words. And that night, they came upon the temple and burnt out its roof, and smashed down its walls with great golden hammers in defiance of the success Ben had earned. When Ben saw what they'd wrought, he wept. Not for the temple. Temples can be rebuilt. Not for himself. He knew the permanence of his temple had been an illusion, and that, though it had been built for him, it was in no way his. He wept for his brothers. He wept for the anger that had turned them from joy. He wept for what he knew was next to come. For the townsfolk came to Ben and cried out at the sight of the ruins, of what they'd built. 'Who did this?' they said. And Ben, who in his virtue told no lies, answered them, 'My brothers.' He tried to salve their anger, to tell them this was an earthly matter, that more stone could always be dug from the ground and set in place. His words fell on ears deafened by righteous rage. The crowd marched upon the house of the brothers and drove them out. They put the fine house to the torch,
and the brothers to the sword. The flames of their destruction cast long shadows on the town. They spared the father, the old man, and with damp cheeks and beard he walked from that place forever, taking with him Ben's black dog.
Samarant paused to smile forlornly, and from his distance Dante saw Ben's terrible sadness reflected in her eyes.
In time they built a new temple. Its spire kissed the heavens. It was more beautiful than the first. They brought Ben to it, and said unto him, "We are sorry for the fate we brought your brothers, but they tore down what we put up." Ben looked at them and nodded. "I do not condemn you," he said. "There was no right in what they did." "Then we did right to burn their house, to plant them in the earth," the people said. "No," Ben said, and he held up his hands for silence. "I do not condemn you, but do not mistake vengeance for justice. The gods look on us all with sorrow, for truly we have forgotten the harmony of their sphere." The people bowed their heads. Ben returned to his sermons, and the people returned to his temple. He spoke with joy and with righteous visage, and never again let the townsfolk see the sadness that had stolen his heart.
Samarant sighed. She stepped down from the altar and paced its steps, meeting the eyes of the barons, the ship's captains, the farmers, the docksmen, the landed gentry, the wandering vagabonds. She turned her back on the assembly and stepped back up to her place at the altar's peak. A few men coughed, muffling their weakness in their hands and cloaks. She let a minute go by before turning her plain face back toward their sight.
"The jealousy of men finds us all. The men of the south and the east, even some of our brothers and neighbors in our own land of Gask, they look on what we do, and they mistake piety for threat. Who is Aron? He takes us all, this much is true, but he does not seek nor want our end. He takes us in his time, and when he does, he welcomes us to his fields in the stars. Still, we strive for Ben's virtue, his patience. We try to make his peaceful compassion our own. We try not to blame our brothers for the wrongs they do us. After all, they are our brothers. I've been to a dozen lands, and I see the same faces here as any corner of the earth. Look around you. Go ahead."
Thousands of faces turned and met each other. Samarant met men's eyes and nodded.
"I see the same men and women, sons and mothers, uncles and sisters as anywhere else. Are we so fearsome, so foreign, such a menace to the ordered world?" "Maybe we are. Our brothers think so. When they see our temples, they look upon their own mortality. When they hear our scripture, they hear the bells that toll for their souls. When we speak our truths, we speak of things that trivialize the weight in their purse, the bounty of their soil, the flash of their brooches and rings. Still, we want no man's death. We don't even seek to own his mind, which is more than can be said for some orders of the House of the Belt. We want nothing more than a place at the table."
"In the end," Samarant said, clasping her hands before her, her voice clear and pained in the open air of the great cathedral,
"who is to be blamed for the chaos we have seen? Is it our brothers
for their failure to understand us? Is it us for having the temerity to raise arms to reclaim those things we would build upon the face of the earth?
She pursed her lips, shook her head.
Let us seek to be like Ben. Let us take no pleasure in whatever we must do to keep our temples and our faith. The gods do not smile as we bury our dead. Not even Aron wishes a man's blood to fall before his time, no matter what the men of other gods may say. We are not right to take their blood, no matter how wrong they may be to make us take it. Remember that. Whatever we must do, they are our brothers. They are our brothers. When they die, we must weep. We must be like Ben. Live this earth. Live this earth, the crowd responded, and this time Dante heard their words in a mixture of tongues. Samarand nodded simply. She stepped down from the dais and was surrounded by her clergy. For a long while no man spoke nor moved, their minds consumed by the truth of her parable. At last the men on the benches closest to the dais stood to speak to each other, or gazed longer on Saruman's face, where she exchanged words with the others of her order. The standing crowd blinked away their trance, and the singular acoustics of the room dissolved into babble. A general movement toward the front doors began.
"Let's get outside," Dante said. "Get a good spot for her to walk back." Blaze nodded. They forced themselves into the crowd. Dante glanced over his shoulder as he shuffled forward, trying to catch sight of the woman in black and silver. She would be delayed with her duties to recognize the presence of the men of importance who'd attended her sermon and now waited for her in the first rows. The rest of the masses oozed toward the doors, a foot every couple seconds. After a few minutes, the blockage gave way, and the people thinned, and the boys could walk at something near a normal pace.
"She tells a good story," Blaze said. "Reconsidering. Pretty words don't change what she's doing down in Malin."
Dante nodded. "No swords." He glanced around the square, shielding his eyes against the glare of the day after the dim of the church. "I may be able to do it unseen."
"Right." They drifted a short ways from the straight line between church and keep. The square was filled with men just milling about, talking over the speech, discussing what they'd do for lunch, a confusion of Gascon and Malish, and a couple other minor tongues Dante couldn't place. The gates to the sealed citadel were open, but blocked by a black mass of guards. They weren't expecting Samarand to be long, then.
"I wonder how she does that," Dante said.
"Does what?"
"Reconciles what she's saying with the burning of Wetton. All the things they're doing down there."
Blaze rubbed his left eye with the back of his hand.
"She probably doesn't think she's doing anything wrong. Otherwise she wouldn't be doing it, would she?
But it's acting more like the townsfolk than Ben."
"So?
That was just a story.
That's just something they say to keep everyone else in line."
"Yeah. But doesn't it bother her?"
Dante stared into the space above the heads of all the people.
"I really think she believes it.
It's so hypocritical."
"Ben's a dream, you dummy. Something to keep little people like us happy and faithful while she's off getting things done. She's not moping around worrying over the state of our souls. She's off fitting the worlds like a glove to her hand."
Dante looked at Blaze, alarmed. He was supposed to be the clear-eyed one, not Blaze. Blaze was supposed to be breezily unconcerned, unflappable. Something in his speech reminded Dante of the careful parsing he imagined Samarand must do to cleave her beliefs to the things she did.
"How does someone get like that?" he said.
Blaze shrugged, spat between his feet. We've killed a lot of people to get here.
But we had to, Dante said.
Blaze only shrugged once more. Dante watched a half-dozen troops march with pikes on shoulders across the square. A few pilgrims continued to trickle from the church doors. No sign of the priest. He took a drink of water. Though he could feel the pressure of his blood beating in his veins, his hand was oddly calm. He smelled the stink of the city and its people, the shit and the rot and the sweat, odors his nose had ignored since the day of their arrival. If he concentrated, he could isolate a score of different conversations. The sun shone from the stones of the street and the faces of the buildings. It was a nice day.
"Did I tell you?" Dante said, a grin replacing the brooding on his face. "The morning they were set to hang you, I wrote a letter to be read after my death."
Blaze's face lifted with laughter.
"What did it say?"
"I can't remember. Something about how I was off to save my friend and I expected to die in the doing."
"I'd have traced my middle finger."
"I wasn't in the best of moods," Dante said, shuffling his feet. "That was actually the least hysterical thing I could come up with." Blaze nodded. He rubbed his clean-shaven jaw.
"What would you say now?"
Dante thought a moment, giving the question its due.
"I'd say hello to Callie and Gabe and Robert."
"That's it. That's it. What would you say?"
"I'd ask them to catapult my body through the roof of a nunnery."
"You wouldn't," Dante said, wiping cold sweat from his temple.
"Why not?"
Blaze yawned into the sunlight.
"What would you do if a body came crashing through your roof? Scream, right? Get all excited? I'd like to think my last act was to give the sisters a little fun."
"Shut up," Dante laughed.
"They spend all day reading holy mumbo-jumbo and squeezing their legs together. Don't tell me they don't deserve a good time."
"There she is," Dante said, grabbing Blaze's arm. He bumped him toward the cathedral. Men clustered up around the doors and called out to Samarand from the midst of her retinue. She met their wide-eyed gazes with a look of pleased shock. Men called out for blessings, falling to their knees at her feet. She touched their hands and brows, and Dante could see her lips moving. He called out to the shadows, just enough to make sure they were there. They waited, restless and snapping, as if aware of his intent. Samarand waded through the penitent. A number of armed and uniformed guards followed the troop of holy men, but they cleared no path, letting Samarand mingle with the faithful. Dante grasped Blaze's cloak and forced them forward, trying to guess her course. A dozen priests at her side, as many guards. Not a chance for a straight fight. He had it then, the plan that had till that moment been so nebulous and abstract. A single dark stab at the woman when she was too close to detect it before it opened her belly, then blend off through the crowd. Simple enough. His ribs felt prickly, like a hill of ants were walking up and down his skin. Samarand made no hurry through the surge of men and women seeking her touch, her words. More pushed forward to fill up the spaces as soon as they opened. She came closer. Men walked away dazed and smiling with parted lips. The process was orderly in a way mobs weren't. Dante pulled his lips from his teeth, turned it into a tight smile to try to match the faces of those around him. He heard the musing tones of Samarand's voice, and then the laughter of men. The priests clasped hands with men in gold-threaded capes and soft-furred cloaks, leaning in to exchange counsel and well wishes. The knot grew nearer. 30 feet off now. The eyes of her bodyguards were clear, casting through the men who thronged around her for the glint of daggers or the shadow of nervous faces. Someone bumped into Blaze, and he fastened his fist tight. The boys exchanged a look. Blaze's eyes were flat, cold, ready. Dante imagined his own as their mirror. Samaran smiled, bowed her head to someone's kind words, and Dante remembered all the men she'd sent to kill him. The dragging gasps of their last breaths, the way they'd hounded him through city and forest, letting him be baited by the book, then making him fight his way to their favor or die on their blades. Like beating a pup until it was ready to prowl the grounds with nothing but hate for any man it saw. She would deserve it, he knew. She wasn't like Ben. She treated people like tools to keep her safe behind her high walls. 20 feet away. Ever closer. 10. He could hear each of her words now, the thick-tongued scrape of Gascon. He moved to put Blaze to his left, between him and the citadel. He slid his knife from his belt and sliced a shallow line over the ball of his left thumb. Blood wormed into the folds of his hand. A single bead rolled down his palm, dripped to the street. He closed his eyes to catch his breath. When he opened them, she was standing in front of him. Their eyes met. Samaran's were a sky blue, airy with the peace of her 50-odd years. He saw no violence in them. She was a good liar then. She murmured something in Gascon, and he steeled himself against a flinch as she reached out for his forehead. Her fingertips were warm. She looked at him again with kind creases in the corners of her eyes, and he felt a yawning fear sweep through the marrow of his bones. He let the nether wait. When she moved down the line, when she turned her back, he dipped his head to mimic the gratitude of the others. He kept his left hand clenched, blood slick between his fingers. Samaran smiled at him again, and turned to Blaze, who doffed an imaginary hat. She laughed, took his hand. Dante held his bleeding fist against his stomach and sent for the nether. He found nothing, an emptiness he'd never before felt. His breath shuddered. At once the shadows flooded forward, filling his vision with grey. He looked down and saw a violent darkness surging around his hand. Samaran said something holy-sounding to Blaze and moved along to the next man. It was time. Release it. Split her chest so no man could mend it. Use his blood to spill her own. She shuffled along. Blaze glanced at him from the corner of his eyes. Dante licked his lips. The high collar of a priest brushed his nose, and he jolted back and nearly blasted the man with the shadows he intended for her. Heads craned and waggled between his and hers now. He thought he could feel the weight of her presence, the deep substance that bulged beneath her skin. Release it. Strike her down. His fingernails bit into his palm. Blaze's elbow nudged his hip. He shook his head, paralyzed, but quivering. She was well into the crowd now, hidden by the upraised chins of those she'd passed, by the bulky shoulders of monks and men-at-arms. Dante let the shadows fade, felt them burn along his hand as they dispersed back to the cracks of the earth. I couldn't, he whispered. I know, Blaze said softly, but Dante saw the doubt in his eyes. Dante closed his own. Laughter and chatter battered his ears. I was waiting for the moment, but when it came, I couldn't get a hold on it. We can find another, Blaze said. We know where she keeps herself. They threaded their way from the square. Dante didn't reply to Blaze's simple stabs at jokes, and after a while of walking, Blaze began humming a hopeful tune he'd sounded along the river beyond the mountains. Dante let out a long breath. His feet ticked over the cobbles. He rubbed dried blood from his hand. Blaze led the way. He gave no thought to their path or the city around them, and was mildly surprised some blank time later to find themselves back at the house they called theirs. She had meant to take his life. She'd tried it on four